Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 16th, 2004. Today's session number is BRM 2004-04. Today's speaker is Mark Bracker. The lesson for today is Ethics Empowered by the Gospel, Free to Be Responsible, a Christian Concept of Vocation. Let's listen in.
To be responsible, a Christian concept of vocation. So I want to try to develop a concept of vocation that's along the lines of the ethical approach I've been developing. If you haven't been to any other sessions I've been doing, I think you'll still have the basic elements that you need will be here and you'll be able to follow this. We'll work through, I'll develop this concept of vocation, and it really forces us to take a look at what we understand Christian freedom to be. So that's part of our task, is to identify an understanding of Christian freedom. We'll draw specifically on some key quotations from Paul to do so. And then at the end, I also want to lift up some criteria for discerning our calling or vocation. Now, in one sense, I'm using calling or vocation to embrace all that we're called to do as followers of Christ, people of God. But there is also a sense in which we need to make decisions about what is it that, what could even be a job or an occupation that if you're going through that kind of decision, there are some criteria that we can lift up. They don't just lay out an answer for us, but they function as kind of parameters for us in thinking through those kinds of questions, and I hope you'll find that helpful. The first thing I want to do is to do the what I call priming the pump, and some of you will have done this already this week, but I've got one question for you. In the Pledge of Allegiance, we speak of liberty and justice for all. What do we mean by liberty, and how does this concept of liberty compare with the Christian concept of freedom? And from your standpoint, the best you can, what would you say if you had to try to explain that to somebody, or to explain why you don't quite know, or what it is that's difficult for you? Just do it in groups of three or four. I'm going to give you a few minutes. This will prime the pump to get us into the topic for the day. Discuss that question, and then we'll gather back together and continue. All right, I'm going to call your attention back here. I assume you have not exhausted this topic. But it sounded like it was doing what I hoped, which was to get you talking about the topic, so I can prime the pump. We'll have a chance then to follow up with what you're discussing here, because it'll come into play as we go through the time. And again, I'll go through things. If you have points of clarification, just raise them along the way. And then at the end, we'll leave some time for just a conversation with one another about this particular topic. First thing I'd like to lift up, if we're going to develop a concept of Christian freedom, is that we need to understand that there are elements of freedom that involve limits or boundaries for us as Christians. And Martin Luther was quite helpful on this, and he was influenced by the Apostle Paul to a great extent on this, and all the biblical teachings by Paul on freedom. But Luther, in the Freedom of a Christian, an essay he wrote, he identified what he called two presuppositions on freedom and the bondage of the spirit. And he said the first presupposition is that a Christian is a perfectly free Lord, subject to none. And so that whole notion of being a free Lord, subject to none. And then he said a second one that goes along with it, and you have to hold on to both of these presuppositions. The second one is that a Christian is a perfectly dutiful servant of all, subject to all. Now, this is very Lutheran to have paradoxes, and so this is a classic Luther paradox, is that we're Lord of all and subject to all, and you hold on to both things. And then, of course, we need to unpack that, and he does that in the Freedom of a Christian. We'll be doing that here, too. I've given a little different twist. You know, some of this I picked up from Bonhoeffer along the way, but I've had to add to it that there are two factors that condition what we might call the life of responsibility, or the life of a responsible person. The responsible person, in one sense, is bound to God, to other human beings, and to all creation. So So in that sense, we're bound. There's a relationship that we're bound together with them and responsible to God, human beings, and the whole of creation. At the same time, there is this quality of ability that we have to freely respond, to God, other human beings, and to all creation, where we have a real responsibility in the kind of responses that we engage in. In terms of responsibility, another key concept I want to introduce here is the notion of responsible action. Responsible action. And definition I'll give for that is it's self-giving action in response to God, other human beings, and the whole creation. So it's self-giving. There's an element of giving of oneself. And then we can qualify that even further. There's a sense in which this self-giving action needs to conform to Jesus Christ. And one of the models or identities that Bonhoeffer worked with was the notion of Jesus as the responsible person par excellence. And I found that helpful. Now again, simply knowing that Jesus is the model, we can't just follow everything that Jesus did, walk in his steps, and then we'll solve all we need to solve in terms of living out our lives. But there clearly is a sense in which Christ functions as this responsible person for us, gives us a concrete understanding of what it means to be a responsible person. And I used a comparison earlier, the earlier session this morning, that it's when you have a chalkboard and if somebody puts their fingers on the chalkboard and just make the hair stand up on end, or everybody has something like that kind of gets to you. There are times when we don't know exactly what Jesus would want us to do, but we know that what we're doing or what somebody else is doing just doesn't fit with who we understand Jesus to be. And so it's that sense. It's not an exact way to identify responsible action, but it can give us a sense of when something is not responsible action. A second part of responsible action is that it fully employs our God-given abilities to respond. And so there's real sense in what I'm doing. Am I making use of everything that God has made of me and the community I'm a part of? Does this responsible action fit who I am, fit who the community is that I'm a part of? That's another, again, kind of parameter or measure or guideline that can help us in discerning responsible action. And then a third thing is to ask, does this build up the responsible community, build up the church? Does it build up that which is good in terms of our corporate life and our communal life together? Or is it, no, this action really seems to be tearing down. It seems to be isolating. It's not building up that which is good. It's not contributing to the health or the vitality of the communities that we're a part of. And I want to draw a distinction for you between what we might call everyday responsibilities and extraordinary responsibility. And I want to talk about God-given responsibilities, and I've even started hyphenating response and abilities, because there are responsibility, when we use that word, we tend to think of obligation, those things that we are obligated to do, take care of our children, do our work. For part of the church, we need people to do what people need to do in the church, for the church to function. We have obligations as citizens. So there is that aspect of responsibility, and I don't want to discount that. But I also want to lift up, there are abilities we have to respond that are not necessarily obligations, but part of who we are. And it's the full range of those responsibilities that are more like obligations and those abilities to respond that we have that together give us our everyday God-given responsibilities. I'm just going to list the variety of those responsibilities. For example, a basic one is family. So that includes the support of family and nurturing growth in the faith for children, if we're responsible for children. That's caring for our spouse, if we're married. It also, though, even if you're not married, you have no children, in all likelihood there may be a relative or two that you are part of your extended family. And so those extended family obligations are part of that responsibility. And I would say even for somebody that may end up living, if your household, let's say you even had a household that you weren't directly family members, but you were part of a household, I would say there's some obligations that go along with those that in some sense resemble family obligations, although you could also understand that in terms of friendship, and friendship is another ability to respond we have. There's certain, and that can really cut both ways. There's an obligation to a good friend is somebody that does certain kinds of things for a friend. Another clear responsibility is work, and in work we participate in the action of creation. God is the creator, but we are invited to participate in that process of creation, and the work that we do contributes to that. Citizenship is another responsibility. In citizenship, we actively participate in the political community and process. And in our particular system, that's a kind of democratic process. But whatever the political community you were part of, there is a responsibility to be an active participant in that as a citizen of that community. I would include culture among the responsibilities that we have. And culture can include art, music, literature, customs, and all of these participate in and are helpful in building up a life of a community. And so that's why I think it's important to lift those up and not shortchange them at all. Friendship, I already mentioned. Being part of the church, there's the worship life of the church, and it's so important to the worship life of the church for people to gather together regularly. People come up and every once in a while, you know, kind of apologize for not being in church, and I try not to, you know, say, why aren't you in church or something like that. But there is a sense, what's regular attendance in worship? Well, there's no formula for that, but we really do need to gather together regularly as a community of faith, whatever that means. Here at Holden, it means every day. You know, we gather for that evening worship. That's the nature of this community, that's something that's strongly encouraged. It's as required as can be without being able to require it, I guess would be another way to put it. But then there's the mission of the church that's part of that responsibility that we all have. I would include recreation among our responsibilities. There's rest, renewal, and just enjoying creation and play. That is part of who we are as responsible people. We need to engage in recreation. And if we do not do so, there are consequences for us as individuals and also consequences for the community. And then one last one I have is education, the importance of growing and learning, and in a sense all of you are modeling that this week, and I'm here and I'm doing some teaching, but I'm also you're always a student when you're a teacher too, and so for me and for our family, that's been part of this week for us too, is the whole educational element. And we might say, well, you go on vacation to go through and study and do classes. Well, who's to say vacation has to take only one form? And so a vacation hopefully is an opportunity for rest and renewal, but certainly this kind of learning can be part of time away that hopefully will be restful and renewing and important in terms of our growth as responsible people. Now, the crunch is, I've just given you a list, and this list I've been developing over time, and so this is where it's at this point. But then we need to balance our responsibilities, and this is where the crunch point often hits for us. There's so many, and I would say, I'll just talk about my generation here, the baby boomer generation has struggled with this big time in terms of balancing responsibilities, and in a lot of ways we haven't done a very good job of it, just to be blunt on that, how we do that. And this is where I think an element of grace comes in, because you start talking about responsibility and all these things that we could do or need to do, and that can feel, we can feel a weight from that. But one of the insights that I've gained from Karl Barth and Bonhoeffer, and it's a term that they didn't come up with, but they stress that we do not live constantly as Hercules at the crossroads. In other words, not every moment is a crisis for us. We don't have to do a case study every decision we're going to make during the day. We could drive ourselves crazy if we were overanalyzing everything we do all the time. Now, at the same time I say that, it's also very important that we be reflective on our lives, and to take time along the way to reflect on how things are going in being a parent, or in being a spouse, or how is it going with my friendship with this person? What about my life in the church? So there are times when we do need to take time out and reflect on how that's going, but much of the time we simply need to be able to fulfill the roles and responsibilities we've been given, and simply to do that for this day, or this week, or this month. God doesn't want us to wear out in a conflict of responsibilities and decisions. And that is a common affliction today, is that people just plain are wearing out. Now, I'm not talking about having hard work and getting tired, but I'm talking about where you get to that point where there's just this kind of steady weariness in people's lives. I don't believe that God intends for us to constantly be weary. It's why even those that are living in slavery, where you have an extreme situation, different than our own, you know, the God of our, what is it, our weary years, or there's this one hymn that's sung, but this constant weariness, this isn't what God hopes and intends for us, to have that ongoing weight hanging over us. God doesn't want us to live as this every moment is a crisis or this extreme burden. God wants us to be free to carry out our God-given responsibilities and do that and live, in a sense, with a measure of grace. That's what God's intention for us is. And unfortunately, there's no exact formula for balancing on this. But there may be times, and I cherish them when they do happen, where things just seem to be clicking and working well. And you're taking time for adequate rest. You're able to fulfill your basic responsibilities. And even if you hit some tough points, you work through them and you move on. There's a certain rhythm that God intends for us as responsible people in our lives. We do, it's important to recognize, as responsible people, when we freely exercise responsibility, engage in responsible action, that we do participate in building up the church. And this is emphasized in Ephesians 4, 11 through 16. Talk there about the different gifts and how if everybody's using their gifts and doing what they're called to do, the community then functions and is built up and functions well together. Now, having said that about what God intends for us on a day-to-day basis, there are moments where extraordinary responsible action is called for. And it's extraordinary, so hopefully it is not the norm for you, but there may be somewhere along the line, and nobody can tell you ahead of time when that will be, when you may be called upon, or your family or your community that you're a part of may be called upon to engage in this extraordinary action. There's an element of risk is one part of this. There's an element of risk. We may even in these kinds of moments, and it's how do you know you're in one? I'm trying to give some clues of how you actually know you're dealing with an extraordinary situation. You may have your responsibility in one area may directly conflict with another responsibility or something you're being called to do. Let me give you an example that in our own society, in terms of the civil rights movement, here you had Martin Luther King Jr. that was, I believe, called to be the leader of the civil rights movement. And he perceived that call and acted on that. Very serious consequences for his family because of that. When your dad's a leader of a civil rights movement, it means you may have to worry about whether your house is going to be bombed. And imagine growing up as a child worrying about whether your house is going to get bombed and where people have actually threatened to do it. Imagine being his spouse and having him gone all the time, and then as it turned out, he was unfaithful to his wife. And so another consequence, not to focus on the unfaithfulness, but clearly that relationship with his wife suffered because of his involvement in this civil rights movement. So very serious conflicts, and finally, in that case, he had to go ahead and continue to be part of the civil rights movement, and he ended up then finally being killed because of his involvement in the civil rights movement. So that is a public example that we know of someone who faced this kind of extraordinary situation. Someone earlier was sharing an example where she just went through the process of moving her parents out of their home they lived in for years, and then into different living circumstances. And that, she described that, that was, I think, a kind of extraordinary situation where you, now there's no exact model for doing that, and it was not easy. You don't quite know if you're doing the right thing at times. That's the kind of another example of that. Another characteristic may feel like there's the ground is moving under your feet in this particular circumstance, and you boy, I think I should do this, but I'm not sure because the things you've learned along the way aren't quite answering the issue or that you're facing, and so I'm not quite sure where to go on this. You're not maybe well grounded in terms of your faith and what you've learned along the way, but somehow what you've learned doesn't quite answer the situation you're in. You know, maybe you're on the job and you've got a co-worker or a boss who's doing something unethical. And what do you do with that? Because there's some serious consequences no matter what you do. Staying quiet, maybe living with your conscience is one issue. It may let that unethical behavior continue. But if you speak up, you know, will things just bust apart? Will a company come apart at the seams? Will you end up with people out of work, families going without adequate financial support? That's another situation where you might end up with an extraordinary kind of situation. I've talked this week about Dietrich Bonhoeffer and his involvement in the conspiracy against Hitler. I think this is an example of an extraordinary situation. And clearly in Nazi Germany, or in Germany, there was no basis for a Lutheran pastor to be involved in a conspiracy to assassinate the head of state. There's no principle or guideline or basis that he could draw on and justify what he was doing. Simply wasn't there. I mean, couldn't tell everybody, obviously, on that kind of thing. But even after the fact, his friend Eberhard Bethge said, even after the fact, he would acknowledge there's no way to justify what we did. We did it. He would even give an account of it and say, I was compelled to do what I did by who I am. But there's no... The ground, literally the ground is moving under your feet in that kind of circumstance. And another point would be Bonhoeffer would acknowledge that their response to the situation there may have been a tardy one. And I would say even in our own context where we're a little more vocal about criticizing our political leaders and can get away with it without getting thrown into prison, at least most of the time we're able to do that. Even in our own situation, I would say if you're a pastor or if your own pastor got involved in trying to assassinate the president, I think you would say that's not the pastor's job. I think there would be even people that, you know, it wouldn't matter which political party you were belong to, it's just not what you do when you're a pastor. So that was clearly an extraordinary situation for him to get involved with that. My point is, the extraordinary situation doesn't mean you're taking on the whole nation or either, or something like Bonhoeffer, Martin Luther King. The example I've talked about, the lady talking about her parents and moving them, we will encounter somewhere along the way, we're going to have at least a circumstance or two where we'll have to make that kind of decision. And finally, we just have to take responsibility and dare to take action at that point, even when it's not clear what we're going to do, and we have to risk even doing the wrong thing at times. And sometimes we're choosing between two things that we don't like either of the choices. But finally, we do need to act. And doing nothing is still an action. In this way of understanding things, if you decide to do nothing, you try to wash your hands of the matter, then that's your response.
Well, that's kind of like Pilate.
Exactly, yeah, like Pilate. Well, So we don't get out of this. There's no way to avoid these kinds of decisions. A couple other things that I want to share with you. In terms of what constitutes real innocence in terms of this, in making ethical decisions and fulfilling our responsibilities and roles, and real innocence is not keeping ourselves free from the taint of sin and guilt, or washing our hands of the matter again. Real innocence is willing to, in a sense, acknowledge that we're part of, whether it's a sinful family, a sinful community, a sinful congregation, a sinful nation, and not trying to step outside of that and kind of from a position on high and throw down stones of judgment upon people, but to saying that, yes, I'm a part of this community. And it may be that there are particular people who have contributed more to a given situation, but we accept responsibility. And so when we see the pictures of what happened to the prisoners in Iraq, we feel the shame. We feel the shame as part of a nation. Not just saying, well, those people screwed up and get mad at them, but we acknowledge that we're a part of this, and we accept that as part of who we are. We accept the fact that we're Americans and fellow Americans did what they did in prison there. And even, I would say, we even have to think about that in terms of our being part of humanity. When we see the atrocities that happen in some of the civil wars and tribal wars around the world, we don't just throw stones at that and say, look at those people are doing that. There should be a sense in which we feel the weight of our fellow human beings are doing such things. Now, this doesn't mean you let people off the hook. Those that were involved in the prison abuses do need to be held to account, and action will be taken. And hopefully things will be learned from that, and steps will be taken that will work to bring some correction to that. But we don't stand outside and try to maintain some sense of ethical righteousness or purity over against others. I've used the term the black hole of ethical purity. I think any attempt to maintain our own purity or the purity of our family or our nation or our congregation is a black hole, and it saps the life right out of us. And I'm not a physicist, but the term black hole, I have this sense that black holes just suck everything in, and I think it really sucks the life right out of us as individuals and as part of a community. In terms of the concept of freedom, then, bringing some things together, Paul says, for freedom Christ has set us free, Galatians 5:1, and then he says, don't submit to a yoke of slavery. You know, you've been freed, don't submit to this yoke of slavery. And what's involved in this yoke of slavery? Clearly, any form of self-indulgence is a yoke of slavery. So just doing your own thing and whatever you want to be would be an extreme form of that. That is not freedom. If you can think you want to do whatever you want to do, that's not freedom at all in this sense. Any attempt to seek to justify our actions, you know, maintain some sense of purity over against others or in our own minds about ourselves, is also a yoke of slavery. True freedom, as Paul defines it in Galatians 5, 13, 14, this picks up again on these two factors identified earlier, would be when we're serving God and serving other human beings, we're free. Or to put it another way, when we're fulfilling the calling or the vocation that God has given us, we're free. If we're not fulfilling it, we are slaves. That's a yoke of slavery. Another aspect is part of freedom is that we do have a real responsibility for shaping life's events in history. We participate in that process, and we need to acknowledge that. If we shortchange ourselves or say, well, nothing I can do can make a difference, and get that kind of passive attitude, that would be to shirk our responsibility and, again, to submit to a kind of slavery. When it comes to our actions, we need to finally let God be the judge. So we engage in the actions that we do, and God will then finally judge them and carry forward that which needs to be carried forward, leave behind that which needs to be left behind. We are constantly making judgments and discerning what we need to do or what, no, I don't think that person should have done. I think that was a mistake, or what our congregation is doing, I'm not sure about that. That's all appropriate. That's part of the process of discerning our calling and vocation and working with other people. But there's another step when we step over the line and begin pronouncing judgments and ultimate judgments upon ourselves or other people, and that's simply not our role and not our responsibility. That is God's. And Martin Luther had a phrase, sin boldly, and I would suggest that was not about, well, sin and do whatever you want to do and God will forgive you. It's about being willing to take action and respond to God and others and risk, you know, the fact that we may do something that is sinful and will need to be forgiven. But we still dare to take action, even when things are not perfectly obvious to us what we need to do. Any comments or questions? I'm going to go on then and just briefly list some of the criteria for discerning our calling or vocation. But any comments or questions at this point?
You make a distinction between ordinary and extraordinary. Is this a case where you can, is there a definite definition or distinction that enables you to classify anything one way or the other, where you see this as a continuum of increasingly serious situations?
I think it's a continuum, but I think in the most extreme extraordinary situations, it's that time when you finally just say, I don't have the basis to deal with this. I mean, I don't. And then you really, it's just one of those, and you almost have to be in it to know it. Now, I have done, and it take more time than we have here, I have done a presentation where I work out parameters of for discerning when you're in an extraordinary situation. I have done that, and I did a little bit of that for you, but that's a more expensive presentation. But it is almost something you have to recognize when you're in the middle of it. And the point is, you know, the Ten Commandments and all the basic values we live by, they really do work for us quite well most of the time. I mean, they really do. And so you can live by those, and what you learn growing up, what your parents teach you, can be very valuable to you, and being part of a community of faith, and we work through these things, and you've got guidelines on the job that help you. But then there, every so often something comes up that simply, the resources, you just don't feel like you've got the resources there to deal with that particular situation. And that's risky, because then you're really on the front lines to the extreme when you're in that kind of situation in terms of taking action.
That's when you pray.
You pray and do everything you try to do everything you can to help you figure out what to do, but you really have to dare to step forward and on behalf of the community, the church, and God, to dare to take action at that point.
Your initial list of things, one thing that I see got left out is economic situation and your ability to respond.
Okay.
Like, I'm thinking, a rich person, everybody gets their clothes dirty. A rich person might send it to the maid to take care of it. A middle class person might go to the laundromat. Somebody in India might beat it out on the river. So that your economic status does make a difference in your ability to respond. And I think that's something that as Christians we tend to not take into account.
Important factor. Yeah, and that's an important factor. Sometimes the role of, in the church, we'll talk about stewardship, and I don't mean just what you put in the offering plate, but their role as stewards might come in along these lines, and our ability to, what we can do as stewards, our economic circumstances clearly can influence what we're capable of doing in specific situations.
Mark?
Yes, David.
Relative to extraordinary circumstances, we were talking about Pilate washing his hands. I read somewhere that what he was actually doing there was mimicking a Jewish rite which says, I am unable to perform the tasks of my office.
Oh, interesting.
Give me a break. I cannot protect the innocence of this man, Jesus, who I believe to be innocent, and negotiate the politics of what you're trying to do to me.
Okay.
This is an extraordinary. I cannot do what I am called to do here.
Oh, that's very good.
And the Jewish response to that extraordinary circumstance was confession, give me a break, let me off the hook. You got to help me here.
Yeah.
And the response was, we'll take responsibility, for this screw up. But yeah, it's just one way to negotiate extraordinary circumstances, I think.
That's helpful, because if you're in a situation where you're not able to fulfill your basic calling or responsibility, that is an extraordinary situation. And that's helpful, I think, to a good parameter, a checkpoint.
And Pilate not being a bad guy.
Right.
I want to protect this innocent man.
Yeah.
But I can't do the politics of running you Jewish folks at the same time.
Yeah. All right, anything else on that? Well, let me lay out some criteria then for you for examining your kind of the scope of responsibility, your calling, your vocation, any of those terms would work there. I'm going to use four from Bonhoeffer, and then I'm going to add a fifth, and then I've got some other questions I've come up with that may be helpful to you. Bonhoeffer identified four criteria. The first one is that you don't want to extend or limit your responsibility or calling on the basis of a principle. And I've talked about this earlier this week, but there's a danger in trying to take one principle or fact and say, well, now I'll make my decision based on that. So, I mean, the most crass one would be, my basic principle is I'm going to do whatever makes the most money for me, because my goal is to make a lot of money in life, and so that's what I'll do. Now, that's a crass one, but I'm trying to give you an example of where you take one principle or one factor, and that decides what you're going to do. So, this job, man, this will pay me more money than I could ever hope to have. This is the job I'm going to do.
What would be another example of that that isn't so negative?
I never want to do a job where I may not be able to where I can't tell the truth all the time. I never want to be in a position where I can't be perfectly forthcoming in being able to say whatever the truth is, where I don't have to compromise. So you look for a job that doesn't get you in too many of those situations, and this is a safe job for me. That could be an example of something like that also.
I always want to be in a job where I can help people.
Okay.
And that's a positive thing, but I don't know any job in the whole world, given the circumstances, that you're always going to help all people.
Yeah. All right. So even the most positive principle could be misused, where, you know, we can argue with helping people, but your way you think about that may have... And the point about why not do it this way? Because the danger is if you adopt one principle or try to find some, you know, simplify the process of discerning what your calling or responsibility or vocation is, you're going to miss your calling, potentially, because you're not taking things into account that need to be taken into account. A second criterion is that zealous reformers must guard against equating their reforming impulses with the call of Jesus Christ. So if you have a tendency to be kind of zealous and jump on the bandwagon, I mean, he's cautioning that. And then to equate that with the call of Jesus Christ. And I assume that most of us, if you've been part of a congregation, could identify something along the way in the life of that congregation where somebody got on the bandwagon and was sure this is what God and Jesus wanted us to do. But there was may have been what the zealous reformer would want to do too, and so it gets a little cloudy in that. So just a caution again. If you have that tendency to be zealous, just be aware of that and be careful before you too quickly identify that with the call of Jesus.
Judas was a zealot.
You know, okay. Judas, that's an example. Judas is a zealot. Next one, the third one, I'll speak. This tends to be very characteristic of the Scandinavian tradition that I come out of. To be overly cautious, duty-bound, law-abiding, and prudent. And if you have a tendency towards to be that way, you need to guard against too narrowly limiting the scope of your responsibility, because then you're going to try to find, you want the responsibility to be something where you can be duty-bound and law-abiding and feel like you're doing things right. So if you have that tendency, be careful again about limiting your responsibility too narrowly.
So was that one of Bonhoeffer's things that he lifted up?
Yeah.
Control yourself.
Yeah. And let me give you an example of this in a church situation. I've seen, and I mentioned this earlier, so some of you may have already heard this, food bank. We have a wonderful food bank at our congregation. And really helps a lot of people, but we could get so excited about our food bank and the good it's doing and how good we can feel about our food bank and how we're helping people that we avoid getting involved maybe in some political issues in the state of Washington that are a little messier and tougher to deal with, but we'll just stick with our food bank because we're sure we're doing a good thing there. We'll avoid getting involved in working with the legislators and things like that. And here we had, for a time this last year, Washington had the worst hunger problem in the nation. And Oregon was right behind, and then I think they flip-flopped for a while. But if we're in a state with one of the most serious hunger problems in the nation, food bank's a good thing, but there are some other issues that need to be dealt with there. So that's where that tendency to narrow the scope of our responsibility can maybe lead us to miss something that God is calling us to do. The fourth one that Bonhoeffer lifts up is we should focus on the call of Jesus Christ and not ourselves. It may seem obvious, But when you're trying to discern your calling, your vocation, your responsibility, focus on Christ. Focus on how in Christ can call us through the neighbor. You know that Christ appears to us in the neighbor. Matthew 25 goes that direction. But again, get the focus off of ourselves. And this is another one that would indicate if you're just worried about yourself, or even if you're just worried about your family. As important as that is, there's a bigger picture here that needs to be taken into account. And focusing on Christ can get our attention simply off of ourselves. That does not mean we should just not worry about ourselves. Taking care of ourselves is different than being focused on ourselves in a self-centered way. And a lot of people don't take care of themselves very well, and you know that then has consequences for a lot of people. So caring for ourselves is not a problem. I think a fifth criterion to work in here is that we take into account the creation that we're a part of and the environmental impact of what we say and do and get involved in. In this day and age, we simply have to take that into account. And we are suffering the consequences of not paying enough attention to that. And that's in this century and probably the next one. I mean, environmental issues are going to be front and center for the foreseeable future. And if we don't deal with them, the consequences will be even more severe than they've already been. Question, who is my neighbor? Since you know, we have a strong emphasis in our Lutheran tradition. Luther emphasized the neighbor, and he's not alone. It goes right back to the teachings in the Bible, the importance of the neighbor. Got to be careful not to ask that question, who is my neighbor, and artificially limit then who we end up dealing with. Could be somebody right next door, could be somebody very remote from us that God is calling us to respond to and reach out to. Fourth thing, I want to lift up another point here. We need a willingness to enter into the fray. Non-involvement to protect ethical purity. Non-involvement to protect our own ethical purity or sense of righteousness is irresponsible. Non-involvement for the sake of the neighbor, however, may be a fitting response. So, you know, if there's a lynch mob and you choose not to get involved, just the act of not getting involved in that is a responsible decision to make. That's an extreme example. So there are times when non-action is what you're called to do. But it's for the sake of the neighbor. It's not non-involvement because, well, we don't want to get our hands messy. Don't have to deal with this situation. It's too difficult to sort out, so I don't want any part of it. That's where we get irresponsible. In terms of discerning our occupation, and to become more focused here in particular on an occupation. This I got from Paul Gerseld in Making Moral Decisions, and I thought there were four helpful questions I wanted to share with you. Is this the kind of work for which I am suited in temperament, intelligence, and training? Is this the kind of work for which I am suited in temperament, intelligence, and training? Does it fit who you are? Second one, is this work that I can enjoy and from which I can draw a sense of accomplishment and fulfillment? Work I can enjoy and draw a sense of accomplishment and fulfillment from. You know, obviously other responsibilities may dictate that we don't get to pick that kind of work, but it's certainly a factor. And if somebody has to labor for a long, long time in something that they don't derive any sense of fulfillment or accomplishment from, that's a tough road to go. It is a sign that you may at least want to be open to some other occupation if God presents, if circumstances present you with another opportunity. A third one is, does my occupation or profession fit into the larger sense of vocation given by the gospel? So how does this work that I'm doing fit in with the whole range of roles and responsibilities that I'm filling? And then D, the last one, does God need this done? Does God need this done to help in the transformation of myself, my neighbor, and the world? And so the other thing I'm saying here is that, you know, if it's something that needs to be done, and it works into the scheme of things in your life, and you do get some measure of enjoyment, accomplishment, fulfillment from it, and you're pretty well suited for it, sometimes you just need to say thank you for that, and not worry too much about it at that point. Simply do that which you're given, and then every once in a while, if you're fortunate enough to be one of those people that just hits the right thing at the right time and you just love your job, then you can really rejoice. But obviously that's not always the circumstance for many of us. And there's seasons in a job too where you may go through, this is not to say that you won't have some tough times on the job for a while, but really looking at a long haul to really, is this what God really is calling me to do? And these kinds of questions can help. All right, that's what I have. Comments, questions, things you want to follow up on?
Maybe taking this for granted, but I'm thinking in terms of being daily grounded, and then to the last statement, is God empowering me to do this? Tasks that that you hate and you won't get around to doing it are probably not your calling. But even impossible tasks that you have the foggiest idea how to do it, but somehow God produces energy out of it.
Yeah. And question there is, what's
well, the in your list of things, is this something God wants done? Is God empowering me to do it?
Okay, yeah, that would be a good question to add to that list. I gave you the list he gave, but in other words, if you have something you think, I'm being called to do this, but the resource, in whatever sense you want to talk about, the resources aren't there, spiritual resources, the material resources, all that goes into that, that God, if it's not provided for, well, then you can't get it done. So
I have a friend who's a neurosurgeon, and he loves to say that if you love your work, you'll never work a day in your life.
Okay. Yeah, you brought up neurosurgeon. I've always said, you know, we think of arrogance as a bad quality. When I have a neurosurgeon, I want him to be the most arrogant, self-confident person alive. So I hope that's... I want that the nerves of steel when you're working on my brain.
Yes, yes.
I was not called to be a neurosurgeon, so I do know that.
What about the circumstances that, and I can't think of one at the moment, but where you're flying in the face of utter illogical circumstances, and because it's happened, and you know that it was the right thing to do, but there was no logical basis or reason for why you should have been a part of something.
Yeah.
We face those also, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, what is it that Kierkegaard had a sign about being, he compared faith to being, what is it, over the sea, you know, 1,000, I don't know, can't remember the number, but this deep, you're right out on a limb. Maybe that's the image to use. You're out on a limb, and that's having no ground under your feet. And at that point, you know, it almost takes some insight. Somehow you've come to the point where you know, it's the guidance of the Spirit in that, and there's just no formula to help you at that point. And you've got to dare, if you discern that God's calling you to do something, becomes truly an act of faith at that point. And if you try to justify that to anybody, it just won't make any sense to them. And, you know, why do you, and people have, oh, I'm thinking about somebody perhaps that's given up some job where they're making, you know, great salary and they're able to support their families and they just do something completely different. You know, and you just, huh? What's this person doing? You know, what's going on here?
Luther would say that wealth is the least of all the things that God gives you. Of the worst, wealth is the least.
Okay.
And he would say that in the priesthood of saints, if you're a happy commode cleaner, but yet you're an unhappy billionaire, the commode cleaner is a lot better off than a millionaire.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Well, I have people, even with the adoption of these very dark black children.
Brown, they say.
They call themselves brown, but I mean, they are. I remember people just questioning, what are you doing? You know, look, your kids are almost raised. I mean, it costs so much money. It's going to be hard for them. I mean,
These were all very good questions that were raised.
Who raised those questions?
It's like when we, in our church, our big problem was we immigrated a couple from Ethiopia, and we were, not a couple, two families, and took care of them. And we had a lot of consternation is, well, there are people in Houston, Texas that we could spend that money on. Mm-hmm. Why do you go to Ethiopia?
Mm-hmm. That's good.
And the response that the church gave and the pastor gave is, yes, we're going to Ethiopia because they don't have the opportunity. Mm-hmm. There is some way to self-help amongst the people in Houston, but these people in Ethiopia are totally without hope. Mm-hmm. And so we immigrated them, and it became a very fulfilling thing for our congregation, and we were a mission congregation at the time.
But it was not without controversy. And probably you could still have people could raise good arguments even after you gave the reasons you've given. There would be some people who would still raise questions about that. So finally, see an action you may take. Just because you've been bold and done it doesn't mean then it's going to be well received and blessed by everybody down the line.
Right, at a certain point you just act. At a certain point we just did it. And and sure, we could have spent that money to feed a whole bunch of other people, or we could have saved, you know, this forest, or we could, I mean, there's lots of things you can do with your money, but at a certain point, I think personally, I then felt, I felt a strong call, and so I just acted on that.
You're like Nike, just do it.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like the way you're describing it, Donna, is almost like that you're looking at that extraordinary responsibility that in adopting those children was an extraordinary responsibility, but you've moved it to an everyday responsibility. I mean, they're
now it's obvious that they are here. It's kind of like after the child's born, you deal with the child. And after the child's adopted, there's no... And that's how it was for me. I had very strong reservations. Not about adopting from about adopting anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just... We'd raised three kids, and why do I want to do this again? But now I wouldn't have it any other way, because we've taken it on. That's very helpful, because we've taken it on as an everyday responsibility.
Yeah.
You and if you've been a parent before, when they're all 14 and 15, you'll say you would might have it another way for a moment.
For a moment,
you know. You'll get over it, but for a moment you'll think, oh, I wish.
Oh, boy. What was I thinking?
It seems to me that at a certain point, you know, when you, all those people were asking those questions and trying to, you know, in a sense asking you to justify your actions, you lose the need to justify it.
Mm-hmm.
When you start doing, I mean, I've had situations in my life where I've had to make a decision that I couldn't justify to anyone.
But
at first I felt the need to try to find a way to justify it, and when I knew I was making the right decisions, when I no longer felt the need to justify.
Yeah.
This is my heart, this is my life, this is my decision. And it might not make any, I could look them square in the eye and say, you're right, but I have no way of justifying this, but I don't need to.
One of the things that's helpful that picked up from studying Bonhoeffer's situation is that there is a difference, and it's kind of thing where it's not easy to draw the line, but I'll try to draw it. There's a difference between giving an account of what led you to the decision you made and then going the next step, which is trying to justify it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you may have done something along the way where you say, well, you know, and it may not even be just this nice logical explanation either. Well, these kinds of things happened in my life, and then I came to this point, and you give some kind of story of how you arrived at the decision you made. But it doesn't really justify it, it's just giving an account of it. Now, I recognize it's very easy for giving an account to move into justification. So this is not a nice, clean line to be drawn. But it is helpful if we can at least tell the story of how we came to the point we did, and that can be very helpful. But then to try to just avoid that temptation, and it's just human nature to want to justify ourselves. It just is. It's so hard to avoid that. And when you find yourself doing it, and you finally realize you've been doing it, I think you just have to confess it and move on. I mean, it becomes part of who you are. I mean, as Lutherans, those of us who are Lutherans get it drilled into us that you're sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And we're not alone. Presbyterians learn this, and others do too. But that's just part of who we are as human beings.
I think the interesting dynamic there, and it's not true of your relationship, it's true of my relationship in similar situations, it sounds like Donna was the one who said, who had a sense of call.
Yeah.
This is what we need to do.
you sit there going, oh my God, this is going to spin out of control. But in terms of being community, when someone has a sense of call or vocation or ethical sensibilities, and the community, the marriage or whatever, are not sure about this, nonetheless makes choice, then the vocation becomes slowly co-owned within a larger community.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's not one of the ways God summons out for us. Because as I've listened to the discussion, I've been trying to think of what's different between an individual ethical decision and how does the community participate in that. And it seems that part of what God does is use us individually to begin to take us communally to where we can't go together. If that makes sense.
Well, that just light bulb goes on. Even look at people like Martin Luther King Jr. You know, he has a call and a vision, and then others get on board, or Rosa Parks, you know, someone who takes a small action and connects that together. And sometimes then you may not be sure of the call, but you have some sense that this person is onto something here, and so you choose to go with them on that. You don't want to do that mindlessly, but that's, I really appreciate that insight.
From the standpoint, if you look at it, if you take in the community of the church, how many times do individuals spark an idea that the community accepts? Sometimes they don't accept it, but it makes a difference in the community. Whereas it's very difficult to get the community to give a consensus to approve something where one individual says, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and I can't seek your approval. I can't justify it, but I'm going to do it. And then all of a sudden the community says, well, that's a good thing. And we grow in that, and it's a part of our community now. And I think that's what Martin Luther said, or says, go out and sin boldly.
That would be
the community might not agree with you, but the community acquiesces over a period of time and gets involved in it. Whereas if we do it from the community, and the whole community has to approve it, we may argue about it for the next 15 years.
And then there's also times when it's good the community does not go along with somebody's harebrained idea or something like that. But my guess is even your congregation, probably one or two people got excited about it and then shared it and about going to Ethiopia. There might be other projects that we could cite that where somebody gets excited about it, and then over time, others are willing to
act on it. Three of us did. Right. And we had the means and the mechanism to do it without the church, but we asked the church to be a part of it.
Huh. Interesting. Last comment here.
I come to the Lutheran tradition late, and so this is a very basic, on-the-ground question. I'm struggling with an ethical dilemma. When do I call my pastor, and what do I accept from the pastor as far as what can a pastor really, how can a pastor really guide that decision? In other words, what can I, what expertise coming from the pastor, how can the pastor help someone that's trying to make an ethical decision? Maybe not necessarily an extraordinary one.
You mean just Well, I'll offer a couple of insights and then maybe others, and we'll say we're ended now, but we'll finish this question, all right? Because it is.
If you're responsible for children, you can go and get them.
Yeah, you could go do that. I think in the Lutheran tradition, we would say make use of your pastor. Hopefully, there's in terms of understanding of biblical tradition. Theological tradition, those kinds of resources should be something the pastor could help you with in sorting that out. In the Lutheran tradition, we'd get very suspicious, though, of trying to, in a sense, whatever the pastor tells me to do, I'll do. That's not being a responsible layperson in the Lutheran tradition. So you want to take very seriously what's shared with you by pastor, or we talk about the priesthood of all believers. There may be others in a congregational situation, trusted people that you'd want to talk to and say, I think this person really helped me sort this out. And we would also argue there'd be people outside the Lutheran tradition that may be helpful to you on a particular circumstance. And if you want to know something about you know, you may be better off in certain things. You know, if it's a medical issue, talk to a doctor. If it's a legal issue, call Texas and talk to Damon. Although I guess Texas law isn't that helpful to us in some of the, some other things we found out here in the state. But it's that kind of making use of the full resources that God provides, and doing that. I think at times we could do much more for each other in terms of discernment and corporate discernment. And maybe we can learn something from the Quaker tradition. In their, they have these meetings for discernment. And I think we could do a Lutheran variation on that. The difficulty with those meetings, though, is those presume a high level of trust. So it's really part of the ethical task is also figuring out who to talk to. There's no, in a sense, there's no stepping outside of the process. Even what you just asked, and when you have a next ethical decision you need to be making, who you decide to talk to is part of the process. Yeah. Last comment here.
I guess I was just going to say, don't pastors oftentimes serve as a good reference point too? I mean, I think as far as in terms of people going to a pastor, they're, well, what can they do for me? If nothing else, they could probably offer you some suggestions and maybe just get a pat on the back and say, you know, you're going to be okay, and then let's get you moving the path you should be going down.
Yeah.
They might not have all the answers, but they might serve as a good reference point.
Yeah, and that would be good pastoral care guidance. And I will make the point when people come to me, and I almost exaggerate it, and our insurance companies want us to do this these days. They'll say, I'm not a counselor. You know, I don't just automatically say that the first thing, but if I have a sense that people are really coming to me and they're dealing with some counseling issues that need to be addressed, I'll say, you know, I think it would be best for, I'd be glad to talk with you as a pastor, help you sort this out, but I also think it would be valuable for you to see a counselor and make a referral, and I've seen it work quite well if I'm working with a counselor on certain kinds of issues, and so they're talking there, and I'm willing to talk. No, I want you to come back and check in with me and just how to go with a counselor and so on. But I just think there's such a need, though, too, for attending to, I use the word theology, but good thinking about God and our situation as people of God and disciples of Jesus. That should be something that a pastor can be helpful with, and then fellow disciples and fellow people of faith, and utilizing the whole people of God and the whole counsel of God in that. Well, thank you. I appreciate the discussion with you.